I had a show on Friday night. And
what kind of stuff do you do, roughly?
My holy trinity of songwriters is like Elvis Costello, Tom Waits, and Robin Hitchcock.
I like Robin Hitchcock a lot. Of those three.
Yeah.
Those are the guys.
I love Robin Hitchcock. Love Robin Hitchcock.
Did you turn your thing on, or are you
going to
do that?
Not yet. I'm going to in a second. You were asking me questions, so yeah. I didn't know if I was supposed to talk about me yet.
Well, I could be part of it.
Yeah, so I love those sorts of people, but I grew up playing classical piano.
Oh.
And so, yeah, that's my background. And then when I was in high school, I learned a little jazz from...
Did you get to the point where you were improvising a bit, or?
I don't think I started improvising until I started writing my own songs.
So you do improvise? Mm-hmm. I see. Do you improvise with a voice ever, or not?
I've never done, like, scat singing, if that's what you're asking.
I wasn't even trying to be that specific about it.
So growing up, there's always been sing-alongs. Like, I've always had a huge group of musical friends, and there's always drunken sing-alongs. And, I've been given, like, solos, so for, like, the oohs and ahs and things like that. If that's what you're talking about, like, improvisation,
That is an example of it, yes.
Yeah, so it's not... I don't think of it as that complicated, but I suppose I think of it like... my other trumpet player that I work with, not Theo, this guy Dan, who's a grad student at Berkeley as well, but he studied trumpet at Columbia for a while, and then moved back out here to do grad school out here. But anyway, Dan has a very... like, singing-type way of playing the trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very intuitive, and it just kind of, like, is all by ear, and that's how I sing, too, even though I'm a classical pianist, so I I like to know where I'm going.
My thing is all by ear, too. We can get into that if you want, but, yeah.
I would love to. But, yeah, how did you come into music? I know I read on your website that you didn't start into music full-on until you were 31 or something
right.
like that.
So, the way it started is, I mean, first of all, I come from a family of professional classical musicians, so I'm the only person who's not a professional musician in my family. So, my sister's a violinist in the Cincinnati Symphony, my mom is a retired violinist in the Cleveland Orchestra, my father's a bassoonist in the North Carolina Symphony, and my late stepmother was a French horn player in also the North Carolina Symphony. So, I grew up entirely around Western classical music from when I was literally 0 years old. I mean, like, when I was in my mom's womb, she was... you know, playing chamber music concerts and practicing 6 hours a day and stuff like this. So that was the world I grew up in. And then in terms of things related to the kind of stuff that I would do now, jazz, if you will, my dad had a bunch of jazz records then, and so he was kind of a jazz fan. He was not an improviser. None of my immediate family members are improvisers or who have ever really improvised or tried to. But I got some interest in it from that. And then when I went to high school, a guy that I roomed with, I went to a residential high school in Durham, North Carolina, which was a science and math focused high school. One of the guys that I roomed with had a much deeper experience of listening to jazz and improvised musics of different sorts.
So hold on, you managed to not play any instruments while you grew up in this musical household?
Yeah, so I'm a pretty hard-headed cat, and so I basically did what I wanted to do. My mom and my dad did try to get me to play violin for a while, and I did not take to it at all. I did the minimum that I could do and have them not be ultra pissed off, and then right when I, you know, could get away with not ever doing it again, I didn't. I knew from very early on that I wanted to be either a scientist or a filmmaker. I was not going to be a musician, not because I didn't love music, but because I love music enough that if I was going to do it, I was only going to do it. Which, of course, I've decided that I've relaxed that restriction in the last 10 years. But at least initially, I was not going to do music. I was just going to listen to music. So, anyway, so I went to this high school, and this guy, Warren Fryer, who was a good friend of mine at the time and a roommate, introduced me to a lot of more sort of newer jazz things. And then when I went to University of Chicago,
And that was circa when in high school?
So that would be in 86 to 86 and 87.
So the what jazz was doing in the
'80s? Well, yeah, so he was real into things that were like, actually a lot of stuff that, to be honest with you, I'm not so into now, Pat Metheny or Earl Klugh and things like this. But he also opened my ears to a lot of that, but also to a lot of, you know, he was really into Wayne Shorter, like hugely. And so we used to listen to things for hours and hours on end and memorize solos together and stuff like this, and sing along to them. He actually was an amateur trumpet player, He never really practiced very much, so he didn't get very good at the time. But he had really, really good ears, and so we would learn stuff together and listen to stuff together. And then when I went to the University of Chicago, Chicago is a city that, as you well know, is famous for music in general. I mean, they have the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They have a lot of great chamber music and contemporary Western classical music.
They have the Green Mill.
And they have a lot of jazz, of course, and blues. And so when I was there, I didn't go to the Green Mill much because when I was in Chicago, I was under 21. I didn't have a fake ID. For most of the time I was there, it was only the last year that I was over the age of 21. But I was able to go to what is essentially the Chicago equivalent of Yoshi's, which, like Yoshi's, is an all-ages place. It's called Joe Siegel's Jazz Showcase. Still there. Still run by this crotchety guy, Joe Siegel, who's now, I'm sure, in his late 80s, probably. He was not so young then. He was well into his 60s even then, and this was in the late 80s and early 90s. But so there they had, for literally 10, 12 bucks a set, they had people... Andrew Hill, Joe Henderson, Ahmad Jamal, McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones. I saw Clifford Jordan. I saw all of these people, Mark Farmer, multiple times a year, every year. Like, literally, I went once a week, every week to this place, and they had a different cat every week, and it was incredible. And so that had a big effect on me because I got to see a lot of the, you know, modern masters of the music. Playing, you know, very close to me, because this is a small place, much smaller than Yoshi's. I mean, it's really not much bigger than these two rooms here, so it's a pretty small. And for whatever reason, I mean, things were pretty cheap, and I would just get in there, and I'd order my Shirley Temples, and I'd down them, and I would listen to this shit. So that was important. And then when I went to grad school at Berkeley here from 1992 to 96, so I'm a physicist, so I was in the PhD program in physics. And one of the guys that was in the program the same time I was a guy named Vijay, at the time Raghunathan. He's since just changed his name to Vijay Iyer. And Vijay was a guy who was interested in the same kind of physics I was into. So we shared an office together. We were TAing the same classes. And we also ended up doing research in similar areas, although our advisors were different. And we discovered that we both liked the same kind of music, actually, because I was whistling a Joe Henderson. I used to whistle a lot. I didn't sing anything, but I used to whistle a lot just for the fuck of it. And he heard me whistling a specific Joe Henderson solo that he knew. And so we started talking a bit, and it turned out that he was an amateur jazz pianist. And it took me a while to actually go and hear him. He was doing stuff with UC Jazz, which still exists now. And it struck me immediately that this guy was a whole hell of a lot more interesting than your typical amateur. He already had a pretty personal approach, which was sort of culled from kind of a union of McCoy Tyner, rather, I'm sorry, Thelonious Monk and Sun Ra, sort of from that more very percussive, sparse, you know, sometimes dissonant area of jazz piano playing. And he was really into Ellington, too. So he sounded very different than a lot of other people, and he was also a lot better than, like, cats that would be physics graduate students.
Right.
So fast forward to now, I don't know if you've heard of him, but, I mean, he's now one of the most well-known living young jazz pianists, and he's touring around the world, and he's, like, some huge guy. He's probably going to win a MacArthur any minute now. He's, like, a big dude. I mean, he's in the cover of Jazz Times and things like this.
So did he finish his physics degree?
He didn't. So he, after about a year and a half of after he started, he got sufficiently into the jazz scene around here that he just quit completely. Now, Vijay and I used to have really massive, like, I would say several hour long listening sessions every week or every other week in for that first year and a half when we were both still in the physics department together. We would take off and go to either my place or his place. We both had apartments which were sort of on the perimeter of the campus. I lived in I House and he lived in a place that was sort of on... It's okay. He lived sort of in Oxford, and very, very close to the campus, but on the other side. And so we would alternate going to his place or my place, and we would bring shit, and we would literally just play recordings for each other for hours. And so that opened me up. I mainly played him classical stuff, and he actually had a classical background. He did get trained as a classical violinist, whereas I didn't. He did. He was from Rochester, New York, and so he actually did a whole pre-college program at Eastman School of Music and that. So he knew some things about classical music, but he hadn't listened to it in the way that I had. So I played mostly stuff from that idiom, and he played me a whole bunch of stuff, which is probably eerily similar to the kinds of things I'm doing now. I mean, more exploratory stuff that's, you know, kind of freer in terms of structure and less traditional instrumentation, things of Sun Ra, things of various things from the AACM, the people like Muhal and his whole orbit. And so that kind of opened my ears further. Now, another thing I have to mention, I know this is a little long-winded, but one of the reasons that he quit physics when he did was that there was a fairly prominent improvising saxophonist and composer in New York, Steve Coleman. Do you know this guy?
I've heard of him, yeah.
Okay, so Steve Coleman did a sort of 6-week-long residency in the Bay Area where he taught a little bit at Berkeley and then taught sort of and had workshops and things that were not affiliated with UC Berkeley. But he met Vijay, and Vijay helped to organize this little stay for him. And Vijay, Steve got pretty interested in Vijay because he could see, well, first of all, it's a physics cat. That's kind of cool. And Steve has this very heady approach to music, so that appealed to him. And in addition to that, he could see that this guy had some shit, you know, and he was young and malleable. And so he started to kind of really sort of focus his attentions on trying to get Vijay more serious in playing and things like this. And so partly, I think, because of that, Vijay decided to quit physics. He did end up getting a PhD in Berkeley, but in a self-designed sort of interdisciplinary thing on technology and the arts. And his actual advisor was a guy in the music department named David Wessel, who's the director of a thing called CINMAT, the Center for New Music and Audio Technologies in Berkeley.
Is he the guy that's doing like computer programs for improvisation?
Or? Yep, okay. That's the guy. Yeah. So not surprisingly, Vijay ended up actually working with that guy. But then right after he was done with that, he moved to New York, and he's been, you know, on this upward climb through the jazz business ever since. But the reason I mention all of that is that I met this Steve Coleman guy through Vijay back in 1994 when he came, and I got really into Steve Coleman's music. And then after I had already gone away to do a postdoc somewhere near Washington, D.C., and then to come back to take this job, work at Lawrence Livermore Lab now, I came back here in late 1998. That's just when Vijay was leaving. But in the early 2000s, Steve Coleman ended up actually joining the music faculty at UC Berkeley. He's not on it anymore, but they hired him as a sort of half-time but tenured professor, where he would be touring half the year and be there half the year. And during that time, I was collaborating still quite a bit with my former thesis advisor at Berkeley. So I spent one day a week at UC Berkeley, even though I was living at the time in Livermore and working in Livermore. And so I would make that one day the day when Steve Coleman was doing his classes, because he only taught one day. Mm-hmm. Steve and I knew each other, I would come to the class and I would start sitting in the class. And I wasn't doing anything because I wasn't a musician. You know, I was just a fan, so I would just listen. And Steve is a guy who's really into making sure that people hear a lot of stuff. So even if they're, let's say, saxophonists or trumpet players or guitarists or pianists, he requires that all the students in his classes sing what they can play, because he figures that then that shows that they have a deeper understanding of the thing, and they're not just pushing buttons, as he says. So he would have people sing things, and a lot of this was fairly simple shit. Like he'd play something, or it'd be some slowed down phrase of Charlie Parker or whatever, or some head from a well-known jazz tune, and they would fumble a lot in trying to sing the thing, because these guys, most of them weren't really people who had grown up around this music, or maybe even around music, even though they were music majors, and some of them grad students. And I'm sitting back there going, man, I mean, I could sing that. So after a while, I raised my hand and I started singing stuff, and he would, after, you know, and after maybe a few weeks of that, he just said, you know, man, I mean, you're actually fucking up these guys in the class. I'm not sure this is that good, you know. And that evolved into him sort of suggesting to me that, you know, you should do something in music, he said. And in the beginning, he actually thought I should play an instrument. And I'm like, I'm not going to do that. I mean, I'm old and I'm not. That's silly. By this time, I was already 30, at least. And so I kept doing the singing thing. And I slowly got to the point, mostly because of him, he would sort of draw me into taking solos. Even though I didn't ever improvise, I was just sort of regurgitating like what he would play or somebody else would play. But I realized that I could sort of do this. I could hear form well enough to do it. And so I started taking solos in the class, and he was kind of interested in that. And in the student performance of the class, where I was just there to listen, he sort of dragged me on stage and sort of forced me to do a thing with him. And then later, after that, he brought his actual group back from New York, which is a bunch of real bad motherfuckers. I mean, like some of the best improvisers in New York, and he also did the same thing. He sort of like forced me to up on stage with, well, this was actually even in New York. I mean, I went to see him at Tonic, and Jason Moran was playing with him, and a lot of other big dudes, and so he's kind of got me up there. And so I sort of got the picture, okay, here's a guy who's really good, and I've been a fan of his music now for close to a decade. If he thinks I can do this, I probably can do it.
Right.
You know, so that's actually what started it. And so then started the long process of me, you know, back here, just like starting to get my shit together. So one of the first things was that some of the people that I'd known in Steve Coleman's class were undergraduates. They were therefore 10 years or more younger than I was at the time. They were like 20 and I was 30 or so. I got together with them to play offline, and then sometimes they would have little gigs at places like the Cheese Board, which is this pizza place in North Berkeley, and they would have me sit in with them, and that became a regular thing. And then I met other musicians who were in those bands that weren't even in the Steve Coleman class, you know, and so then I just ended up sort of being a regular guy who would sing at the Cheese Board every week and stuff like this. And so I did that for about a year and a half. And then another big thing in my development was that a really fantastic saxophonist named Dana Stevens, I don't know if you've ever heard of this guy. He lives in New York now, but he's from here. He went to Berkeley High, and then he went to Berkeley School of Music in Boston, and then he was in the Monk Institute when it was as part of USC in Southern California, and then he moved back up here, and that's when I met him, and he started a jam session not too far from where we are right now. It's defunct now, but every Tuesday night, so I went to that, and this guy is an absolute motherfucker. He's like one of the best improvisers that I've really ever heard, even though he was quite young at the time. And so I went to that all the time. And since he is so beloved in the scene here, a lot of the best musicians from the Bay Area would come to that session because it was the session run by Dana Stevens. Mm. So people like Howard Wiley, Marcus Shelby, Smith Dobson, this drummer, a lot of very good people.
I'm interviewing Smith in a couple weeks.
Good, so yeah. So that's how I'm sort of, that was kind of my coming out party, because I would always sing at those jam sessions, and they were all there. And so some of those guys, like Smith at the time, had a jam session that he...
God, how old was Smith then?
I don't know. Well, this was...
He must have been a baby.
No, he's not that young, really. I mean...
I think he's like 30.
No, he's much older than that.
Oh, really?
No, he's older than his sister, who's a singer, who's... She might be 30. Mm-hmm. He is probably 34 or 5.
Check one of them.
Yeah, ask him. He'll tell you. But no, he's older than he looks. Anyway, so he is running a jam session at the time at this bar in San Francisco called Dylan's. It's changed its name now. But so they would, you know, they would hear me at the Dana Stevens thing and say, "Hey, man, you sound pretty good. You should come to our thing over here." So I slowly started to go to like as many sessions as I could just to meet people. And at that time, I also was playing with Eric Vogler, who's a guitarist who, I don't know if you've run into this guy yet, but...
Kind of. Yeah, okay. I've run into his music, but I don't know.
Yeah, so he's the main guy. He is like the main guy that I've played with since I've been singing. And he was actually one of the guys that I met in the Steve Coleman class, because he was an undergraduate at Berkeley auditing that class or whatever. He wasn't even a music major, actually, but he was in the class. And he is a professional musician now, just like... other people that you know, that Jacob and such, and kind of in a similar scene. And so we started playing together, and so then it just sort of took off. So that's basically how it started.
Well, just to tie up a couple loose ends on your influences situation. So I was curious what kinds of classical music you were playing for your roommate.
That's a very good question. So what do you mean? Well,
Vijay is who I was thinking of.
Well, I mean, so the kind,
yeah, your office mate.
Yeah. So the stuff that I really was into, I mean, what I am into now that I'm 41 is very different from what I was into when I was, you know, 21. That was literally half my life ago, or 22. Mm-hmm. But the main stuff that I think I was probably playing for Vijay, was a lot of orchestral things. I've found that a lot of jazz people tend not to know very much of the orchestral repertoire, because they think in terms of smaller groups of instruments.
Right. Well, orchestras can be very overwhelming. There's so many so many parts to keep track of.
They can be. Even though Vijay had been in orchestras when he was younger. But so I know that I played him a lot of... I know that I played him a lot of Prokofiev, which I've always been into. I'm a little less into Prokofiev now than I was then, but there were specific things that I knew he would like about Prokofiev. Vijay has a very angular kind of an approach to melody, mm-hmm. and he uses a lot of kind of interesting intervals where there'll be small jumps and big jumps as opposed to just using pentatonic scales and stuff like that. So Prokofiev, he's sort of a champion of really intervallically interesting melodies. And so I remember playing Vijay a lot of stuff like that. I also remember playing Vijay late Beethoven string quartets, which has been a long love of mine. And then I've always really been into Richard Strauss. And I was also, I remember playing him the Barber Violin Concerto and the 4A and First Violin Sonata, a lot of things like this. I'm generally into, or was into, and maybe still am into, music of sort of the late 19th century. That's the stuff that speaks to me the most. I think. So that's mostly probably what I played in. And that's probably still mainly what I'm into now.
Right. So the other question I had about these influences and things, I was wondering if your teacher...
The Steve Coleman guy.
Coleman was taking directly from Lenny Tristano's school of singing when he's asking all these students to do this.
I would say that he probably came to... It's a good question. It's good that you know about that. I think that he probably came to that kind of his own accord. I don't think that he did get into people like Lee, and he knows Lee personally, by the way. But he got into Lee and Warren and those guys much later. I think that it was mainly just sort of his own. I mean, I don't know if there was any specific person in his past that stressed the singing thing. I don't think he would have gotten it by being into Lenny. I don't think he got into Lenny until he was much older, if he's even that into him.
Right. Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I guess in my classical upbringing, we did not emphasize the singing at all.
Well,
it was kind of a shock to me.
Yeah.
It's so simple. It makes so much sense.
Well, yeah, and actually my mom doesn't teach very much, or she really doesn't teach at all now, but the little teaching that she has done, she actually has made the point that she really thinks it's important to be able to sing stuff. She also says that she can't sing anything, but she thinks it's important too. I think that, I mean, there is a very, and I think this is a very interesting subject. I mean, there, in terms of the way that classical musicians are trained versus jazz musicians, I mean, I'm going to say something that might seem heretical to people who are classical musicians, but I think that in a sense, to quote Sonny Rollins, I mean, I think that a lot of classical musicians don't really know how their music works even. I mean, because these are people who are trained to be executants, to execute the thing and to interpret it in certain ways, but they don't have to get deeply enough into the structure of it, but to be able to do that. I would argue, though, that the best interpreters are always going to be the people who hear the most deeply into the structure of the music. And my favorite players, not surprisingly, are also people in the classical realm, are also people who have more than dabbled at composition. Because I think, it's not surprising that those are the people who have more of an inclination towards getting into structure, hence their composing. And then when you hear them play stuff that they didn't compose, it sounds very different than the way somebody plays it who's just started playing the notes,
Right.
So, I mean, I think that people in the classical world should be more into doing that than maybe they are. But, I mean, most of them are not.
I don't think that sounds heretical at all. I think that the sorts of things that you're saying would explain why so many classical musicians, I mean, I won't name names, but I have plenty of friends around here that are classical musicians, have problems going into situations where they haven't been able to practice. So are you familiar with Classical Revolution? Probably you mentioned something.
Sure. In fact, I know the guy who started the whole thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things he likes to do with that group is to kind of like throw in sheet music, very easy sheet music for these people that play in chamber orchestras and things like that. And have them just like read off the sight read right away, something very simple. And oftentimes there's just these looks of like angst and nerves on these people who have just been playing incredibly complicated music for an hour, and now you give them something simple that they haven't been able to like spend time
with. Well, that's a different thing, though, because that's the whole sight-reading deal. Most jazz cats can't sight-read for shit.
But
I mean, that's a slightly different...
They're sight-reading really complicated stuff, right? Now it's almost like, you know, you and I have both been in graduate programs, right? You now have a PhD and all of this. And it would be like saying that we were nervous reading C Spot Run. You know what I mean?
Well,
and
okay.
To say that was purely the reason for this sort of complications they have. And you know what's even worse? I watched a drummer I work with sometimes, Aaron Kerbel, sat down once with these guys and started just like pounding out behind them while they were playing music they already knew, and it just threw them for...
Yeah, well, these are people who really have a very specific kind of performance practice, and mm-hmm. if you take them anywhere outside of that, it's very difficult for them.
For sure.
That's right. And that's true with a lot of music. I mean, it's actually true. Steve Coleman actually used to tell me about, I mean, one of his favorite musicians in the world, who's an improviser, is a guy named Shivaraman, who's a South Indian classical percussionist, basically a tabla or madungam player. Mm-hmm. And this guy, I mean, is an incredible badass, but he, according to Steve, he's a guy where if somebody is not sort of beating out a certain simple thing for him to play against, he sort of gets, like, kind of, you know, hung up. And it's not, I mean, given the complexity of the stuff that he's doing, it's obvious to Steve that, I mean, he doesn't really need to have that, but it's just that there's a certain thing he's used to, you know. And this kind of music, if, you know, in Indian classical music, I mean, this Carnatic tradition's been around 700 or whatever years. I mean, things are done a certain way. Now, all of a sudden, if you do it a little different way, you can't expect people to be malleable, you know. I mean, because that's... And classical music is maybe a rigid in similar ways, maybe.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to say rigid in similar ways because if you're doing improvisational work, isn't part of the idea to kind of keep part of yourself open and not, like, by definition, not rigid to certain things? Like you're.
But improvisation. I mean, it all depends on what specifically. I mean, so for instance, Indian classical musicians are improvising, but that's improvising within very specific sort of norms. And that's actually true for a lot of sort of straight-ahead jazz musicians.
Right, there's a structure, they say, this is the time, or
it's not,
this is the order, or whatever.
There are some people, and I hope to count myself among them, and I certainly think Jacob is an example of one, mm-hmm. who make a point of checking out a wide enough array of stuff and also actually delving into, as a practitioner, a wide enough array of different ways of making music that then, you know, people like us might be a little more malleable. But, you know, if you take people that are used to a certain thing, I mean, they may be improvising, but they're improvising within this particular stylistic area. You know, taking them out of that is really, I mean, just because they happen to be improvisers, they're going to be just as uncomfortable as people who are classical musicians reading music. I mean, you know, because they're improvising, but they're improvising in a particular way, along with particular structures where there's certain stuff going on. The bass player is going boom, 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 and the drummer is going ding, 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 ding. You know, so it all depends on what you're used to.
Right.
Improvisation in and of itself does not imply any more freedom than written music. It's all in the performance practice. You can have a performance practice which is necessarily broad in its scope, and then people will be more able to do a lot of different things, or you could be improvising but along to a particular thing, and then that's all you know how to do. Yeah.
Interesting. So I want to talk more about what it is to improvise and kind of the phenomenology of what's going on, at least for yourself, if not
great
other individuals, you know. But maybe one way of getting started on this is to go back to the idea of, I always forget his name, but the guy that does the computer programming, and he's trying to write a program that can improvise, a computer that can improvise music, right?
Wessel, or... Yeah. There are many other people who have done
There's
that. In fact, the Steve Coleman guy did it. The guy who's maybe the most famous for doing it, and whose work has, I think, been the most transformational, is George Lewis, who's the head of a jazz studies program at Columbia, but he used to be a professor at UCSD, and is also one of these members of the AACM. So he actually has a whole thing called Voyager, which is literally an improvising orchestra. I mean, it's a computer, but it's an orchestra in the sense that it has an orchestral palette in terms of timbre and everything else, and register and dynamics. And
Do you think those sorts of programs are improvising proper, though, in the same way that you would?
Well, hopefully it's in a different way.
Yeah.
But yeah, sure. I mean, it depends on one's definition of improvisation. I think that, I mean, in the case of George's stuff, and in the case of Steve's stuff, I know a little bit about, they're actually responding to the other sounds that live musicians are generating, or other computers are generating. So, you know, in that sense, it's certainly improvisation in the sense that it's not like you can predict what's going to happen, because what it's going to play depends on what is being played to it. So if you play something else to it, it's going to find a different way through musical space than if something else was played to it. So that's definitely improvisation.
Right. I guess there's like this lack of, I mean, it's still predictable in a certain sense, right? There's only so many moves that it can make.
No. Well, let me say it this way. I mean, so that's wrong. The thing is that just because there are sort of algorithms that describe the temporal evolution of something, that does not mean that the thing is predictable in any practical sense. And this is something that's known very much in physics. Mm-hmm. You don't have to take too many equations and kind of couple them together, so-called nonlinear equations, such that even though you can write them down very simply, you get very quickly, if you sort of evolve the system of equations, you can get very quickly to a regime which is chaotic. You've probably heard people talk about chaos, where it's really, you know, what chaos really means is extreme sensitivity to initial conditions. So let's say that I make my inputs to these equations, this set of numbers. Now I make them only slightly different. You can get something where the outcome a minute or two later is so wildly different that you never would have been able to guess that such a small change in initial conditions would have given such a large change in the final outcome. So in that sense, just because you have well-defined rules that tell you this is what the thing is doing, and trust me, in the case of George Lewis's thing, I don't know much about it, but I guarantee you that there are so many sort of different rules and so many different things happening that it is, you know, unpredictable by any human. But even if it were simpler than it actually is, the fact that it's getting different stimuli and everything like this means that for all intents and purposes, it's chaotic. And I can tell you that the electronic musicians that are really doing interesting stuff, I think, in fact, I'm beginning to work with a guy around here named Tim Perkis, who is also kind of in this camp. We rehearsed together yesterday. People that are in this world, they specifically design their musical instruments in such a way so that they have maybe some limited control over basic things, like, okay, high versus low, fast versus slow, blah, 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 blah. But they build enough of these kinds of things in there so that it's not, they can't predict what's going to happen exactly. And that's actually part of the fun. It's almost the reverse of what I'm trying to control every little thing that comes out of my mouth. You know, and I'm pissed off when I try to hit a note and I miss it or whatever. These guys are in a completely different area. They specifically are going to be surprised. That's what they're going for.
Yeah, that's interesting. It reminds me, it's a little bit of a tangent, but I think there might be fruitful things to think about here. Have you seen that documentary called This Might Get Loud? It's about guitar players.
No.
And
I've never heard of it.
It's pretty good. I think it's streaming on Netflix or something. But the interesting thing is you have a bunch of different guitar players who are all famous. And they've got, like, the guy from U2. They've got the guy from Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
They've got Jack White. And so, basically, Jack White is, like, building guitars out of, like, scraps. This is how the movie starts. Like, he's building, basically taking a string and putting a little pickup on a piece of wood out in the middle of a barn somewhere, and then playing it, and playing a song off that, and talks about how he likes the kind of chaos he likes to need to work for whatever the sound is that's going to come out of this thing. And then you have the old guard who are more, like, obsessive about having the perfect guitar that's, like, made just for them, and, you know, it's shiny and beautiful, and, you know, they have total control over. So it's interesting, I think, that you bring this up in terms of electronic musicians, because you would think this more, like, gritty guy out in the barn, right? Like, they're okay with that lack of the chaos factor.
Yeah, that's what they want. I mean, there are, of course, electronic musicians that are trying to control every part of it. I mean, if you look at people in hip-hop, for instance, and I also work with some people in that area, here and there.
Right, the guy in New York.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there, of course, the idea is you are, you're making a track. Mm-hmm. So you are actually controlling every little bit of it to the best of your abilities. But, you know, there's different ways of viewing this. But, yeah, I mean, for myself, it's just my personality. I would never be able to play something where I don't know exactly how it's going to come out. I mean, I'm a very controlling person. So I want to, for me, I don't want to strive for, I mean, I even know some very high-level instrumental musicians. I don't know her personally, but there's a great violinist named Carla Kilstedt who sometimes improvises, and she can play anything. I mean, she's, you know, she can play, sounds great in a Beethoven violin concerto. She sounds great improvising. She can do all sorts of shit on her instrument and voice and at the same time and all this stuff. But she actually will go into some settings where she, you know, tunes her violin in a totally fucked up way, and she doesn't even look at what she's doing, and then whatever she gets is what she gets, and she has to learn how to play that new instrument on the gig. That's not what I would want to do, but I totally respect that. I mean, that's so interesting.
Sounds
to me.
Amazing.
So very, yeah, and she certainly can pull it off, given who she is, but yeah, that's not what I want to try to do.
So tell me more about what you want to try to do. How do you see your improvisational process?
Well, so I guess I guess I'll talk about the process, and then if you'd like, we can also talk about what my aims are as a musician. Like, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. I mean, which one do you want to talk about first? Maybe we leave that later?
Let's use the process first, since I think it's a natural segue off of the things we've just been
Sure. thinking. Okay, so I basically think on a couple of different levels as I'm improvising. There is the level of what I call the micro level, of really, like, what are the notes, how am I going to render them technically, what do I want the phrasing to sound like, what's the relation to the beat if there is one, things like this, do I want to be a little behind the beat, things like this, choices that are really affecting the note by note and rhythm by rhythm kind of thing. And then there is this sort of higher level where I'm thinking, well, where am I going with all this? What did I do, let's say, you know, 10 seconds ago? Where am I going to be 10 seconds from now? And then there's a higher level still where I'm sort of thinking to myself, well, you know, I mean, am I just running off of the mouth, or am I trying to really tell a story here? I mean, you know, how does my thing fit into what Casey just did, or what somebody else just did, or what am I going to try? I'm going to try to lead into this other section of the tune over here, or this other movement of the thing that we're doing. So how am I going to lead into that? Or, you know, so there's sort of thinking on different levels in terms of granularity, like the smallest part of it, and then the next level up, and the next level up from that.
Well, and would you say that you're not holding all of these things in mind, accessing them in your mind as you're performing?
I think I am. So I think I am, and at least for me, I've had discussions with other improvisers about this. People a lot of times say to me that, you know, you do all this, you know, study and work beforehand, and then you get to the thing and you just play. I've never done that. I've never really been able to do that. I'm not sure I want to do that. I want to think. I mean, I may be the only guy who admits that, and maybe I'm the only one who's doing it. But I really want to get there, and I want to think in real time of what I'm doing and make decisions. Okay, do I do this or do I do that? You know, and I mean, and that's really what I'm doing. I mean, I think I see what I'm doing as making a series of decisions.
Right. I guess this just brings to mind all sorts of work I've read on the skill acquisition process in general. And it just seems like most of the time when people get to a certain point with something, which is obviously you are, that they say, they talk of you first as like, you're in the flow or totally in the moment or like standing outside yourself or something. And that's completely not what you're doing.
Nope. Not at all. Not even close. I will say that I have, that doesn't mean, and this is another thing I argue this point with people, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that I'm not emotionally invested in it and that I can't be sometimes swept away by it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's times when, given the circumstance, not because of any sad shit that I sing, but because of stuff that's come right before me or something like this that really moved me, where I'm in tears and I'm trying to sing. And even in situations like that, where I am really in the moment and there's this kind of physical, visceral feeling, I'm still calculating. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out what makes sense here. What should I do? What shouldn't I do? You know, like, maybe I want to do this, but I realize that I might not make it, so I'm going to do this other thing instead. I'm still doing that. I mean, I'm never not doing that.
That's really interesting. That is definitely different from... So you have conversations like this often with the people you're playing with?
Not often. I mean, I think I tend to have more conversations like this with people that I attempt to improvise freely with, because, as I think you know, I mean, a lot of what I do is fairly structured, kind of like doing jazz tunes and things like that. But I'm starting to get more into improvising where there's no set anything with other people who are expert at doing that. And then I'm really interested, since there's nothing to base it off of, I'm really interested, you know, how does this work? Like, and so I've asked everybody that I've done this kind of, that kind of improvising with, which hasn't been so many people as yet, I've asked them, okay, how do you think about doing this? If you have nothing to work from and you just go and you're playing with somebody else, what are you thinking about? And to be honest with you, I mean, the people tend to be very cagey about it. And I don't know whether that's they haven't thought about it or whether they don't want to tell me what they're thinking or whatever it is, but I've never, I mean, you know, I may be the only guy who's really sort of just...
I haven't just talked to musicians about this. This was something actually that I was very interested in for a few years in my philosophical work. But anyway, a lot of times people will... I don't want to say that these people are just being cagey and not wanting to tell you, because I think a lot of times people say that they do their best work when they stop thinking.
Yeah.
So you've put in a lot of time, like, you know, take you, Lauren Benedict, you've absorbed all this music from the womb on, whether it be classical music or hip-hop or you know, the jazz that
right.
your friend Vijay was feeding you. You know, that was in you, and that allowed you to walk up to the classroom that one day and start singing better than all these other kids who hadn't really been absorbing that music all their lives, right? So it's not like, and sure, you were thinking about it, but I wonder at to what level, like, the reason I asked you earlier, you're not accessing all of that stuff at the same time. Can you really think about and juggle three different levels or four?
Well, I have to, but it's not as hard as I think it's not as difficult as you think it is.
Uh-huh.
It's, I mean, when I say these different levels, let's go through what they are again. This sort of small thing of what are the notes that I want to do in this next phrase,
right.
And this slightly bigger thing of, you know, well, how does this logically follow what I did and what I'm going to do, and then this bigger thing of what's the whole fucking point.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that hard to think about those three things. I mean, let's say, think of it this way. We're talking right now, which is a form of improvisation. It's actually not that different from what I'm talking about.
But I'm not thinking about the words I'm saying, like, as I'm saying them. I just kind of, like, think the thought and it comes out.
Well,
right?
Okay.
What you're saying is equivalent to me thinking about every syllable that I'm saying as I'm saying.
Oh, well, okay. So I'm not doing that, but I guess, let me put it this way. As I pause right now, I'm trying to think of how am I going to explain this to you. So that means, that's what I mean when I say the smallest level
okay.
thing. I don't mean. I don't mean, you know, that's not what I'm talking
okay,
about.
Okay, that's helpful, actually.
Yeah, so I know how to, right. I mean, there are things that are internalized that just come out, which are, that has to be that way. But what I'm saying is that I am trying to sculpt my sentences to say the thing in the clearest way that I can. And I'm also trying to, you know, at the same time, I realize, you know, what we were talking about. And for instance, you made the point that, oh, I think maybe we should talk about this first because it follows that, which means that you are cognizant of where you came from and where you're going. And so that's all I'm talking about.
Okay.
And if you can do that in speech, which everybody, one of us does, you can do that in music, you can do that in anything. I mean,
okay.
it's not any different than that.
Yeah, I think that is very helpful. I mean, I guess the way I was thinking about it more is that, like, when I'm playing an instrument and I'm singing at the same time, there's no way I can be kind of playing this game that we do in speech in the same way. I could do it just with the piano or just with the voice, but I would have to, like, give up one of... I'd have to
yes.
give up my
so this,
attention.
Okay, so the here starts another... I'm going to make sure I don't run out of batteries, because soon I might change batteries. We can stop it.
Okay.
There is a... That brings up another very important point, though, which is that to be an expert improviser, not that I'm an expert improviser, but however good I am, I mean, to get to wherever I am, it is necessary for you for certain things to be so easy that you don't have to think really hard about it.
Right.
In the same way that I don't have to think really hard about every little word, otherwise I wouldn't be able to talk, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's certainly true. And when you describe this thing, when you just said about playing an instrument and singing, obviously, it's because you haven't done that as much as you've talked. So, And my guess is that when you talk about the playing instrument and singing, it may be that neither one of those things you've done a whole lot, or maybe one you've done a lot more than the other. So when you do them both at the same time, you know, there's a certain amount of your brain that really has to keep activated on both of them. So that therefore you can't really, you know, kind of stretch in either one very much, because doing both of them together is difficult. If I was scatting and at the same time trying to, you know, to even play the tambourine, for Christ's sakes, I mean, I would not be, the stuff I would sing would not be as interesting as what I'm doing, because I would also have to be focusing on something else. So that's an important part of improvisation too, is like, you know, being, you know, picking a set of stuff and then getting to the point where you're comfortable enough in your own skin of doing that set of stuff so that you can move within that. But yeah, I mean, you give me, you know, if I'm also, you know, counting on my fingers while I'm singing, I mean, then my singing is probably going to suck. Because, you know.
Right, yeah, that's actually a method. But getting back to, like, letting go of and overthinking things, oftentimes, I used to train horses too, right? And when people were kind of moving their hands too much and overthinking the process of whatever it was I was asking them to do, one of the things you'd have them do is start counting in their heads, and it would release their
arms, that's good.
And allow them to kind of get in the flow, if you will, to go back to a kind of vague and maybe unhelpful phrase. But
No, I can dig that. I can dig that. I mean, I think that for me, I mean, I definitely know musicians that are sort of so labored in the execution of what they're doing that everything sounds really stiff.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I don't sound like that. I don't think I do. And I think that's because I've practiced so much that there's a lot of stuff that's internalized. But I guess what I'm saying is that even though I've internalized a lot of things, that doesn't mean that I'm not thinking. What it means to me is that frees up my mind to think even more
about... To go on to the next level.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah, that's good. I feel like... right now, one of the things I've been most curious about is, do you have like a vocabulary for your scatting? Do you say like the same words with the same pitches all the time?
No, so it's not a solfege, if that's what you mean. So it's what it is.
And you did say rim job one time, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I've said I say a lot of things.
Roommate and I were like, what did he say?
No, I know. I've had a lot of, I've said fuck by mistake a bunch of times. There was a singer I used to sit in with who lives in San Francisco, a friend of mine named Mila Milojkovic, and she started laughing one time when I was sitting in with her 5 or so years ago, and I said, what's so funny? And she said, you keep saying vulva. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's certain things that just come out, and it's not some kind of Freudian shit. It's just that certain combinations of consonants
and
vowels.
So you're thinking about the notes, not about... Well, you're thinking about your three levels and not necessarily...
Okay, so the syllable thing. Let's talk about the syllable thing. So when I first started singing, it wasn't shooby-dooby-dooby, because that's kind of some corny shit, but it was definitely more like ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was after several years, embarrassingly, of me doing this before I really started to record myself all the time. And now I obsessively record myself, even when I'm just practicing.
Mm-hmm.
When I started to record myself, and this also coincided with me being on a Steve Coleman recording, by the way, where that was the first time I kind of heard, wow, I really suck, you know, and I actually heard myself recorded well, you know, in a well-known studio. I'm like, that's me? Holy shit, like, I gotta hit the shed, you know. And what I noticed through recording myself obsessively is that every time I would use more consonants, you know, kind of, the more it sounded like a language... the more clearly rendered the notes were for me. And I think part of this is, duh, I mean, you know, we're used to, you know, I mean, we're used to talking. And so why would I, you know, talk like this, like when I'm talking to you now, and then when I go to sing, go blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's just silly, right? I mean, it's actually, it's sort of, I mean, it's not only sounds dumb, but it also is kind of moving away from what it is we already know how to do, you know? So, and part of this, though, is a technical thing. Like, if I'm, let's say I sing a chromatic scale. So that's fine. It's reasonably in tune. But I sing in my chest register. I don't ever go up to the head thing. So it's always kind of grainy. And so that sounds a little indistinct to me. Whereas if I went, Trot when swindim ilgen yogan drop. It's much, then you can hear each thing, because each note has a little cubby hole that you've put
so
it
would
in.
Would you say that the same way every time, or would
no.
you change the syllables?
I could. I would probably change the syllables, but the combinations of syllables that I use because I think that they sound good together. Technically, sometimes it's easy for me to do a fast string of stuff together, or they punctuate a note better so that it's more the beginning of the note is more easily discerned or something like this. So I basically have musical reasons for doing it. Anyway, but the thing is that in the course of the development of this, what happened to me is that, you know, every time I would start to sing a combination of consonants that I hadn't before, like th or something like this, you know, I would go, shit, I mean, can I scat and go th? I mean, and it was like every one of these things was sort of a barrier for me to go. That I was thinking, can I do that? I mean, isn't that going to sound silly? And eventually I just woke up one morning. I literally woke up a given morning after dreaming about this. And I said, well, you know, this is stupid. Why am I beating myself over the head about this? I mean, you know, human language has all manner of phonemes associated with it. Why? I mean, is it really consistent, as I was saying before, for me to be, you know, thinking about all this complicated musical stuff, and then when I, you know, that having the phonemic content of it be so bare bones and stupid, I mean, that's just not consistent even, really. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I realized that what I should be doing is just, like, I shouldn't have any limitations on what I can and can't use in my little scatting vocabulary. I should be able to use anything. And which was an obvious point to me. It's obvious now in hindsight, but at the time it was kind of, I had to kind of work up to the point of doing that. So it was something that really had a technical reason for me doing it. I felt that I could more clearly render the pitches, the sequences of pitches by doing that. But then after having done it, you know, people would ask me, man, what language is that? And stuff like this. And so then I started thinking, well, yeah, that's good. It should be like that. I mean, it should sound like a language. I mean, why, I mean, it, you know, when I hear the singers that sing words, the singers that I like the least are the ones who, where it's all vowels. It's kind of this, like, high school choir kind of thing. Da, 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 da. The singers I like the most, like Nat King Cole or Carmen McRae or whatever, are the ones who, you will take me to, you know, it's the
Robin
ones...
Robin Hitchcock does, is
exactly,
really good at that.
Exactly. So it's the ones that really shape each note like that.
Yeah.
And since I've decided, and I know it's kind of fucked up that I'm doing this, since I've decided to try to make my instrument into a discrete pitch instrument, even though, of course, that's silly because the voice is a continuous pitch instrument, I guess I like the extra added spice that I can bring to each note by choosing a different syllable. So, for instance, I might even sing a given note. Strat, rim, vim, dim, ilgen, yo, hi, vado, whit, vin, trit, vin, pa. You know, and it's the same note, but it's almost like I did it many different ways, you know.
Kind of the same theory, like, I don't know, if you're playing the same note over and over again on the piano, you switch fingers, because it
exactly.
just gets
exactly, resolved. Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So, yeah, and of course the horn players, like Jacob, have false fingers. So they have a thing where they can, you can hear some really good horn players, well, Paul Gonzalez, for instance, the tenor player in the Duke Ellington band in the late 50s and 60s was a master of this. Of you know, you'll hear them do, they'll play the same note, but you'll see here like a different, it's almost like, you know, sounds like they played a different note, but it was really the same note, and what they're doing is an alternate fingering for that same note. So there are many different sort of instances of this, and I just think that it makes sort of intellectual sense and musical sense to do something that's more language-like.
Oh, that's really cool. So okay.
Oh, but let me get back to one thing that I think is going to answer a question that you either asked or are about to ask, which is that I am less conscious of the syllabic part of it in the following sense. When I listen to a solo of myself, let's say we were to listen to some Lauren Benedict right now, and I hear some passage that I did, if you then ask, okay, could you sing that back? I would sing the notes back and the rhythms, but I would probably be using different syllables, which proves that I'm not as conscious about the choices that I'm making there as I am the choices that I'm making
right.
in the
you've shifted your attention
that's right.
to these these levels that we spoke of earlier, rather than, and this is how you could just say fuck every once in a while.
Yeah, because I'm not actually paying attention as much as I should. Now, there are people, most notably Eric Vogler, the guitarist with whom I work, that who think that I, you know, it would be interesting if I if I kind of put more focus on the syllable part. So, for instance, you could imagine getting to a really high level in the syllable thing, such that you maybe cycle through different syllables in at a rate which is different from the way in which pitches are being cycled and things. So you could imagine, you know, doing really kind of interesting things where the pitches and the rhythms and the syllables are all sort of kind of they're spelling out different patterns that all have a complex relationship amongst each other. I don't know that I'll ever work on that because it's just that's just another level, and I think it's so that so the, if you're wondering what I mean by that, just to illustrate, it would be like if I go, let's say if I do, you know, pop 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 pop, those are that's like groups of three things, one two one two one two three one two one two three. Okay, so pop 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 pop. What if I did 1 2 3 4 1 2 3? You know, so that's one. You know, so I pick numbers that are not three things but are four things. 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 1 2, you know, this kind of thing. 3 4 right. 1. So that's where the syllables are cycling against the rhythm. And so you could imagine having this whole extra dimension to the thing, which would be really interesting. I'm probably not going to do that.
Well, it sounds kind of overwhelming at first when you talk about that, but only because you've already given so much access to your levels. But if you had something already written out,
I might be able to focus
this other way.
That's right. So, I mean, I definitely could train myself to be able to do stuff like that. It's not so much my interest, so I probably won't do it.
Right.
Now, there's a whole other issue of, you know, what about words? So I have put the kibosh on...
You're reading my mind here.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I have decided David Wessel, I think, calls this a doctrine of avoidance. I have sort of decided that I'm going to limit my perspective and not try to just sing the whole world. So I am really, really into particularly certain rappers and who are very artful in their use of words. And if I were going to do words, I know that that's the direction I'd want to go in. It's not that I lack an interest in it. It's just that I really think I have a hands full with what I'm already trying to do, so I'm not going to do it. But,
I mean, writing words... So the nice thing about what you have going is that... So I'm a person that writes songs with words in them, and I get really irritated when people use words, but it's just kind of like filler. It's just an excuse to have a singer show up so that, like, I mean, to go back to the jazz idiom, like, we need a jazz singer because people will pay money to go see, you know, some chick in a dress saying stupid words. If you're going to be talking and saying words, I feel like you should be saying something.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So what you've done is freed yourself from that.
Yes, and that's one way of looking at it. Of course, that's the singerly way of looking at it. The way I look at it is that I'm an instrumentalist who happens to use the voice as an instrument. I mean, keep in mind, I came from a family of instrumentalists. All the people that got me into music are people that are instrumentalists. None of them were singers. There's no singers within miles of my ship in terms of what, you know, my, you know, sort of generators of my thing are. It's just that I happen to be a singer. So, or I happen to be using my voice. And this whole language thing kind of developed not by taking actual language and abstracting it. It happened by really trying to be a saxophone on the voice and figuring out how am I going to make that work. You know, and the more language like I made it, the better it sounded to me for intrinsically musical reasons. And so I totally think it's completely valid to think of it from the other perspective, but that's not how I got to it.
So you mentioned earlier about we were talking about hold on, let me just step back here for a second. What I was wondering about now is you talking about being caught up in the moment and the emotive content, right?
Yes.
And so obviously coming from my singerly perspective, I would think usually the way I get into the emotive content of the song is through the words. And that's usually the thing that I get caught up in. Now, I also studied classical piano, so I understand that it come from the other direction, too. And I assume that you're coming more at it, like, from that direction, that the music is making you emotive.
That's right. Although I have to mention that the instances where I have been the most moved by the performances that I've been involved in, not because of anything I've done, but because of the people I'm playing with, mm-hmm. it has been people dealing with words. So there is a group that I'm in led by Howard Wiley, who's a saxophonist and composer, which is called the Angola Project. And in this group, there are three singers. There's me and a very great older blues and jazz singer named Faye Carroll. And then there's an opera singer named Janine Anderson. And both Faye and Janine grew up initially singing in the church. Faye spent a longer time doing that. Janine's doing that now more, too. But Janine's thing is really more like art songs and opera, you know, from the Western classical idiom. But you know, they are singing words, and they're meaning the shit out of them, because these are the stuff that the reason it's called the Angola Project is that it's basically a reworking of and rethinking of prison work songs and spirituals from the Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So this is something that used to be, this is a prison that used to be an actual plantation, and currently in 2011, the inmates at this penitentiary are actually literally picking cotton. Shit like this. So it's like a modern day plantation. It's literally a plantation that was moved over into the prison system. It's kind of fucked up. So the stuff that we do is fairly emotionally charged. And they are singing words, and the words, you know, are things that relate to aspects of the black experience and things in that area of the country. And so I don't know why I'm in the band, but whatever, I'm in it. And so you know, I'm very moved by the kinds of stuff that comes out of them. And so that is an instance of me being very moved by stuff that they're singing, and where a lot of the times part of what I'm being moved by is exactly their interpretation of the lyrics.
Right. Well, that sounds awesome. I'd really like to hear that.
It's out there.
Yeah, I'll have to check it. But so the other thing, do you think we've covered what your aims are yet?
No.
Okay.
So let me stop this and change the battery, and then also get a drink of water, and then we can do that.
Do you want tea? Or-